Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal and I will be mindful of my time. At the outset, I'd like to say that my co-counsel, Mr. Lear, is here beside me and that our primary focus today is on the moral turpitude argument, that it is categorically not a crime of moral turpitude. There are some secondary issues in this case related to the INA 237 offense under and the retroactivity argument, as well as void for vagueness. Mr. Lear is here to address those issues if the court has questions. Otherwise, we essentially submit those on the brief and intend to focus solely on the moral turpitude issue. So I wanted to make that clear to the court. And like I said, he can slide over if that's necessary.
Thank you.
So to my argument, we're not here to defend animal fighting or to defend animal harm. We're fundamentally here to defend the categorical approach. We have two arguments to the moral turpitude issue in this case. First, that the board misinterpreted the federal animal fighting statute, and that is an interpretation to which they are not owed deference. Our second argument is that the generic definition of moral turpitude in this case, which is sort of a subgeneric definition that needs to be compared, is an impermissible interpretation that fails at Chevron step two. And that is because this, quote, socially degrading standard is too far divorced from the categorical approach. It doesn't do a elements matching, but instead it looks at the worst possible harm of the activity generally, not looking at the categorically what the a defendant or a prosecutor must prove a defendant did, and therefore is beyond what is permissible, even at Chevron step two, and therefore unreasonable. So going to the first argument that the board misinterpreted the animal fighting statute, fundamentally what they're saying is that it was, quote, the celebration of animal suffering for one's personal enjoyment, that the statute contained intentional infliction of harm or pain on sentient beings compelled to fight. What we're saying basically is that that is not contained in the statute. From a categorical perspective, the statute is quite simple. It says knowingly sponsoring or exhibiting an animal in an animal fighting venture. So we're saying that the statute on its face is overbroad in that regard. The crime is done knowingly, but the board is not analyzing what exactly is the actus reus, which is very key to the categorical analysis.
I'm just looking at the statute, and there's a definition of the term animal fighting venture, which refers to a fight or conducted or to be conducted between at least two animals. So that's inherently included in what's prohibited, an animal fighting venture.
Right, a fight between two animals, but the intentional infliction of harm by the defendant is not included in that definition.
Yeah, let me interject a question, if I may. How can animals have a fight that's not going to be harmful to the animal that's on the losing side?
Well, I think I would say that there even if there's harm in the activity, a prosecutor doesn't need to prove that there's harm in order to obtain a conviction. And I think it's another question, right, to say that the sponsor intends that harm as if it's a malicious animal abuse crime.
Okay, but normally aren't people held to intend like the natural or probable or universal consequences of their actions?
Well, I think that may be so, but that in this statute, if you look at the plain language and you look at the legislative history, I think that it could be part one of the many pieces of the statute that there is this knowing probable harm, but this is also a statute designed to regulate commerce and public health for disease. That's why it's a federal statute, to transfer the chickens between different states. So I think we could say categorically, every defendant, yes, at the minimum conduct, intends and knows that there's going to be grievous harm to every animal in every case.
Thank you.
So continuing, as I just said, the legislative history evinces multiple motivations, whether it be a large statute designed to make it simple for prosecutors to obtain convictions because they don't need to go in and prove this is a malicious act. This is, you know, if you look, for example, at there's an Oregon crime, which is called aggravated animal abuse, and it's in its elements are to, quote, maliciously kill an animal, or, quote, knowingly torture an animal, with malicious meaning intentionally acting with depravity of mind or reckless wanton disregard for life. So I think the board seems to equate it to a statute that's more like that than this kind of broad prohibition. Yes, the activity should be criminalized. That's not what our argument is.
So assuming for the moment that we agree with the BIA that animal fighting is inherently abusive, is there another problem with the statute? This says person knowingly sponsor an animal in an animal fighting venture, and let's say we agree with the BIA that an animal fighting venture is inherently abusive. So is there another problem with this statute?
Well, I think, you know, I'll put it like this, Your Honor, that I think there's a difficulty when the moral turpitude analysis on a categorical level is allowing, quote, you know, inherent characteristics of a statute to be assumed about what the minimum conduct is.
Oh, are you saying no? You're saying that if we agree with the BIA that an animal fighting venture is abuse of an animal or abuse of animals, then the BIA's determination that 2156A1 is inherently a crime involving moral turpitude is not problematic.
Well, I think what I'm saying is what I would say to that is that there is also an issue which was raised before in this case that it lacks a direct connection to human victims. When we say the moral turpitude generic definition is societal degradation, societal damage, I mean, we're still saying there has to be human victims in a sense. What is society if not these human victims that it affects? And the attenuation between the human victims in this case, because the board didn't say, oh, the animal victims are the problem here. If there's these animals are grievously harmed, then that's malum in se in itself. They said it's a societal damage. And I think that the attenuation between the societal damage, it's sort of like saying, well, when people watch violent video games or violent movies, what is that? How is that degrading them? Versus the comparison that they make to a crime like incest, where you have, they compare that, they quoted the case Gonzalez Alvarado from this court to say that a crime like incest is inherently bad, but that's because it was so similar to the crimes of child abuse and spousal abuse. There was essentially a protected class of victims that they sought to protect. So you have a very close in time victim. Whether it's not, and that one may be slightly outside the elements, yes. But I think this is different where you say, where is the social damage attenuated from the defendant's actual actions? Would you like me to continue, Your Honor?
Can I ask a quick question? The cruelty aspect of it, but generally speaking, so-called chicken fighting or cock fighting is closely associated with illegal gambling. Does that play a role here?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And I mean, I think as we pointed out that the board has held since the 60s that illegal gaming is not a crime of moral turpitude. I think that's a reason to prescribe it, to criminalize it. But I don't think that plays to the idea that it's a broad prohibition and the concerns about illegal gaming are prominent in the reason that it was criminalized.
Okay. And that's one of your arguments. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
So again, the simplistic nature of the animal fighting statute tends to show that it was this broad prohibition that doesn't contain, from a minimum conduct standpoint, complete moral turpitude in every possible way that it can. And, you know, not that the board has to do this, but often the board will show their, the federal cases to prove that there is no such case where it could not contain moral turpitude on a categorical level. The board doesn't show us any cases where, okay, here's, you know, federal case, they're analyzing it on appeal, and there was no possible way that it could not contain moral turpitude. They are looking essentially at the legislative history, the statute itself, and they're basically just saying it's on its face. And our argument is that on its face, it does not contain the type of, they're trying to push in that intentional infliction as if that's an intentional infliction of harm, as if that's in every single case categorically. And again, this just highlights that, you know, this socially degrading standard, while in this case, you know, obviously we're not here to defend the animal fighting, it should be criminalized. It works well with this case to say this socially degrading standard should control in these moral turpitude cases. But this standard is really an expansion in a lot of ways, because it allows it to take any inherent, they describe the activity in broad terms. They describe it in terms that don't relate to exactly what defendants do categorically, but just in a sort of general sense, the worst ills of the crime. And we argue that that has a dangerous precedent to allow a crime that on a categorical level may not contain every malum in se element, but that because they can describe it generally, historically, as something that's abhorrent, then therefore it can take over the entire moral turpitude analysis. You know, as we pointed out, it's not a crime like illegal hunting, a crime like, or even just the practice of legal hunting, where you can use a fox to hunt a hound to hunt for a fox, is just to say, not to say that that's exactly comparable, but just to say that that is enough accepted by society that for us to say this crime is truly malum in se, it's close comparison to activities that are allowed in society, really lends credence to the idea that it's malum prohibitum.
Well, I would suggest that animal fighting is pretty much looked upon with great disfavor in this country. I mean, look at that football player who went to jail for, he was despised for dog fighting. And I don't know, the chicken fighting or cock fighting is very much very far behind that.
Your Honor, I think, you know, I don't disagree that it has fallen out of favor with the American public. I think, again, we're just trying to say that it's at the level that it's every time vile, disqualifies the relief, carries that kind of consequence, is a little, is too far to say that that's the pure judgment of the social mores, especially when you have, in the same year that our petitioner committed this crime, the Puerto Rican legislature in both houses in 2007 declared it to be a cultural right. Puerto Rico has 3 million U.S. citizens, so it has to weigh somewhat into the analysis. And I'm noticing that my time is up, so I'm going to yield.
Thanks for your planning purposes. We'll give you an extra 2 minutes for your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 3 minutes. So, Mr. Sabatino.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. Sabatino Leo on behalf of the United States Attorney General, and may it please this honorable court. Petitioner's conviction for knowingly sponsoring or exhibiting to wit a rooster in an animal fighting venture is a crime involving moral turpitude, rendering him ineligible for cancellation of removal under the Immigration Nationality Act. And really the first question to unpack here is, what are the parameters of crimes involving moral turpitude? And we've heard petitioner argue in his brief and to the court this morning, suggesting that, well, crime involving moral turpitude is this unknown ideal. Well, I will submit to this court that this court unequivocally held in its unbanked decision in Marmolejo Campos that crime involving moral turpitude is an ambiguous phrase within the Immigration and Nationality Act, to which the Board of Immigration Appeals is entitled to deference under step two of the Chevron analysis. And I think really that's the unpacking of these issues. That's really issue number one. Is petitioner seems to suggest that we now have to place parameters on crimes involving moral turpitude, that there have to be these goalposts, and these goalposts are fixed and cannot be moved. But that flies, in our opinion, in the face of this court's decision, as well as an analysis under Chevron. What the court did here in Ortega was remand for the purposes of discussing the possibility or the parameters of crimes involving moral turpitude and whether or not in every single instance it must involve a human victim. And that was in accordance with their Nunes discussion. And I will say that in Nunes it was merely a suggestion, and that was a case involving sexual violence. So I would place it out of sort of that realm and say, what the board does here is provides, I think, what Chevron commands, which is a wholesome analysis for this court with regard to crimes involving moral turpitude.
Okay, and I counsel, think what it, counsel, just, Mr. Leo, if I may interject a question. I was curious about this statute. Would the statute apply to any fighting venture between any two animals? So that if, for example, some clever person figured out a way to train rats to fight each other, would that be a violation of this statute?
Based upon my understanding and my interpretation of this particular statute, yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor, it would in fact be an animal fighting venture when you have an animal A versus an animal B that attack one another. I think what's most important to analyze here, and I think petitioner goes on and on about intent and what is the intent for purposes of this particular statute, and I don't think petitioner ever. I feel as though petitioner conceded this fact in his brief to this court, is that there is a specific intent crime with regard to knowingly engaging. And that's the intent that's required for purposes of crimes involving moral turpitude. I think what petitioner is trying to do here is shift this analysis to now one has to have a specific intent to be morally inferior or morally compromised, like somehow in that subjective mind of that individual has to have that intent and saying what I am engaging in is now morally compromising. If that were the case, Your Honors, my opinion is that there would never be a crime involving moral turpitude. We have sociopaths that run amok amongst this planet that think their socially compromising behavior is perfectly acceptable. And I feel as though that's a shift. And that's an attempt, I think, to dissuade this court from finding really here is that what the board did with regard to crimes involving moral turpitude, and that is specifically that it need not involve always a human victim. I'm sorry, I thought you had a question, Your Honor. Need not always involve a human victim. And I think if we agree, and I think we should agree here with regard to this wholesome analysis with regard to crimes involving moral turpitude, not being subject to these parameters, the next issue really is to unpack is to whether or not this is categorically a crime involving moral turpitude. And this court has repeatedly indicated in its case law before it that says really there are two types of crimes involving moral turpitude, one involving fraud and one involving reprehensible conduct. Conduct that is vile, base, grave, involving depravity. We can agree that this is not a fraud case and we can step aside. But that reprehensible conduct aspect of crimes involving moral turpitude, what in fact does that entail? And this court has continuously stated that there's a culpable mental state and there's socially debased, vile, grave behavior on the part of the individual. And I think if you look at this issue too, and you unpack it correctly, the culpable mental state is there. That was pled. We are not here now to re-argue what the culpable mental state was. The individual here, petitioner, pled in 2009 to a specific intent crime. That, in my opinion, is off the table. So now we go to this second prong or second phase of this crime involving moral turpitude analysis. And we say, is this socially debased, socially grave, immoral behavior? And I think it's clear from the legislative history, dating back really to the colonies, as to far as how we looked as a society on animal fighting and animal cruelty. And I think it was a great example by Your Honor, Judge Ezra, that said Michael Vick situation and how the nation reacted to that situation that involved dogfighting. But I will invite this court's attention to the 1966 Animal Welfare Act and the subsequent legislative history involved in that, and how year after year after year it's been progressively viewed as something that is amoral to society. That is, does not fit neatly within society's moral bounds. And I will say that petitioner mentions Puerto Rico, but in December of 2008, the President of the United States signed into law, my understanding, is a law banning animal fighting in all the territories and commonwealths of the United States. In addition, all 50 states have laws on the books with regard to animal fighting ventures. This increasing national consensus against this activity, I think, is echoed by Senator Susan Collins, who I've quoted with regard to the legislative history with regard to animal fighting, as well as Justice Scalia. I think it's the Paris Supreme Court case saying, it's not a situation, well, it doesn't harm me, so it's perfectly acceptable by societal norms. It is not. These are situations in which these animals are many times drugged, are hyper-aggressive, and fight to the end-all be-all, to the very death of that particular animal, all for the benefit and joy of those spectators. If there is a crime that is more morally torpitudinous when it involves a non-human victim, I cannot think of one off the top of my head. And I think it's also important to recognize that petitioner attempts to equate this to simply watching violent video games, which are, and I'm not a technological expert, but 0-1-0 bits on a computer screen that mimic violent activities among these play characters. These are sentient beings on the planet Earth that we as a society have viewed animal fighting in condemnation. So I think that's another red herring to sort of equate video game watching with actually knowingly exhibiting or sponsoring a rooster in an animal fighting venture. And I also think that the comparison, and I've mentioned that in my brief, and I do quote President Roosevelt with regard to hunting and how our belief is hunting is conservation, and this idea to equate this pain and suffering inflicted on sentient beings for hunting purposes to hunting is really another red herring in this particular case. I think we are in a situation where, yes, animal fighting involves gambling, but it also involves narcotics and gangs with regard to commerce, and especially relevant to this day, the pandemic of the bird flu, as well as morally compromising behavior for individuals to cheer on fighting to the death of sentient beings. And as a result, we think that with regard to issue number one and issue number two, there are this limitation on this ambiguous statute that this court has held as ambiguous to somehow only place it on human victims is completely wrong and in contravention to this court's very precedent. And that two, that the petitioner's conviction is categorically a crime involving moral turpitude for everything that has been mentioned here, as well as in my brief. And I will, in turn, for the remaining arguments, as petitioner asserted that we would rest on our briefs, I will say that I would invite this court's attention to our arguments with regard to the retroactivity analysis, which I think is another red herring, so to speak, which is a non-starter, because retroactivity involves, to even get there, Olivas Malta tells us that you have to have an abrupt change in law, and I think petitioner concedes that there's not an abrupt change in law here. There's not an abrupt change in law by any stretch. So I don't even think we get to that categorical, that Montgomery Ward analysis for purposes of retroactivity. But if this court deems it that we need to move on to Montgomery Ward, I would invite this court's attention to the briefing on the Montgomery Ward factors, and that petitioner fails to satisfy any of them, and that the retroactive application of this is perfectly fine. I would also indicate, and I think this is really what petitioner is trying to argue and trying to shoehorn here, is that CIMTs, crimes involving moral turpitude, are unconstitutionally vague. But we know full well, as mentioned in my brief, that Islas Velos says it's not. And that's, again, binding precedent on this court. And if there are no further questions from this panel, I would say that I am complete at the moment. I would ask that the petition for review be denied, Your Honors. And I thank you very much for your time in this interesting setting. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Leo. And are there questions from... Hearing no questions. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Doolittle. And would the court clerk change the clock from 1 minute to 3 minutes? Okay, please proceed, Mr. Doolittle.
Thank you, Your Honors. Well, I would just briefly respond. You know, I will say, with regard to Hunting, to say that the comparison is not apt, you know, a lot of bow hunters, to say that hunting is purely utilitarian, that it has no comparison to this crime, that it's not fundamentally done for sport, done for enjoyment. I was going to say that a lot of bow hunters, a famous shot is a double lung puncture to hit an elk with an arrow. So to say that that's done in today's modern times for the purpose of food or something like that, I'm not arguing whether it's right or wrong or what it is, but I'm saying that the comparison is similar in that way. Again, I think our major argument is not that this behavior should be defended or that it's, quote, moral, but that the categorical approach is very important, and it's being eroded in these kind of cases where this socially degrading standard allows a sort of subjective idea about the whole activity itself and not just what the person did. I mean, if we say, does a drug person who possesses marijuana, a small amount of marijuana or a small amount of drug, in a sense, right, are they culpable for all the ills of narco trafficking and extortion and murder? In a sense, they are, right, because they're contributing, they're fueling it. But to hold that individual person responsible for all the ills to society is something that I think the categorical approach shouldn't allow. Like you said, we're not arguing that, disagreeing really with the government, that this is an activity that should be criminalized and it should not be allowed. But again, finding that it's a crime of moral turpitude or not finding that it's a crime of moral turpitude will not affect the ability for it to be criminalized and for people to be punished. You know, at the end of the day, we argue that the statute, that right on its face, is overbroad, given that it's a federal statute meant to regulate a lot of different things and that it should be regulated. But moral turpitude analysis is fundamentally about what crimes are so vile, so evincing of the evil mind, that they should be disqualified completely from relief. For example, my own petitioner here, he's been in the United States for 30 years. He has this one single federal misdemeanor. He has 3 U.S. citizen children. One of his children is in the U.S. Marine Corps as we speak. He's, other than, you know, this one crime, he's completely disqualified for cancellation of removal. And I think that that's just to highlight the extreme consequence of the moral turpitude finding. So, again, we don't argue that this crime is categorically We don't argue that it shouldn't be criminalized, but we do argue that the court should be wary of according moral turpitude under this generic formulation. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Doolittle. Well, this argument has concluded, and the case shall be submitted. But before we break to the next matter, I want to just comment that the arguments on both sides from Mr. Doolittle and Mr. Leo were exceptionally well done, and from my perspective, and I thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you, Mr. Leo.
Thank you.
Okay.